I told Joe that I should have announced the topic of rebuttal to Joe Beam. But he told me he preached on grace, so I have no interest in providing a rebuttal to that anyway. I think it's the same message I would have wanted to deliver. Last year, Matt and I went to the Ranger baseball game. We go to half a dozen games every year, drive over from Abilene to the Metroplex. And as we got there, we were seated in some pretty good seats down below. There was a foul ball hit to the second level. And I guess you've noticed how stupid men get with foul balls at a professional baseball game. It's like a test of our manhood to come up with one. And there was on the second level a father who leaned over, nearly falling over, held onto the rail and leaned over as far as he could and snagged the ball. Well, the whole stadium stood and gave the guy an ovation. And with the whole world and ESPN looking on, he then leaned over and handed it to his three-year-old son, who did the only thing a three-year-old knows what to do with a baseball. He heaved it over the edge. It's a great scene, great memory for me about parenting. I think that's what it all comes down to. You give it your best shot, and the next thing you know, some of it's being heaved over the edge. I love the story of the mother who, I read this, an anecdote in the paper recently. A mother wrote in and said that her older child came in about 5 years old, and he's screaming, and mother says, "What's wrong?" And he says, "She," his little sister, 2 years old, "she pulled my hair." And the mother said, "Well, you know, don't be mad at her. She doesn't even know that pulling hair hurts." Pretty soon, mother goes on about her work, and she hears screaming from the other room. It's the little girl, and she walks in, and the little boy says, "She knows now." Well, there's some things I know and some things I don't know about parenting. I've tried to walk us the last couple days through this little 8-part track, because I kind of am one of those 8-track dads in a CD world. When I have a computer crisis, I have to call my teenager in and need that kind of help. My 4-year-old probably could help me at times. Hopefully, some of you have been filling this out as we go. We are, first of all, dispensers of grace. Because we live in a fallen world where a person's self-identity is defined by performance. Every place you turn, it's aggravated in marriage when the church tells you that you can meet your spouse's needs. It's not true. It's called idolatry. Only God can meet our deepest needs in Christ. And so what we do is we dispense grace. We send these messages to our kids saying, "If I could pick any little child in the world, I would pick you. You don't have to do anything to be special to me. You have my grace. You have my approval." Second, we are brokers of time, because that's a commodity and we have to deal with it just like there are brokers of finances. We broker our time, and so we have to beat everything else in the world to our daytimer to say that our children need not just quality time, but lots of it. It's how they learn the faith as they peek over our shoulder. It's how the bond is tied as we spend this time together. Number three, I leapfrogged over this one a little bit. We are bearers of pain. If you sign up to be a parent, you have therefore signed up for some pain. It may be small pain, it may be large pain. It may be the little thing of a child that's got to have minor surgery, or it may be the large thing of a child who doesn't seem to be faithful. But for everybody, there's going to be pain, just as there is for God, the perfect parent. Number four, we are instillers of faith. I pointed us yesterday to a couple of those passages in the Old Testament that say, someday your child will ask you, "What's this about?" And those passages are instructive. First of all, in Joshua 4, because they're not only going to say, "What do these stones mean?" which provides us a chance to give an interpretation, but they're going to say, "What do these stones mean to you?" Joshua 4 and verse 6, if properly translated, "What do the stones mean to you? Mommy, what does this communion mean to you? What does that baptism mean to you? What does church mean to you?" And there we're not just tour guides from the outside. We're speaking from within. This is my story. And then the passage in Deuteronomy 6, your child is going to say, "Hey, Dad, what do those ordinances mean to you?" And you switch pronouns on him and you say, "Well, we were slaves in Egypt." You draw them in. Powerful ways Scripture is telling us how to instill faith in our kids. Number five, we're arbiters of limits. One of the things we're doing along the way is helping our children know that there are limits. There is a place for discipline. But the goal of discipline is not the punishment. The goal is teaching responsibility and decision-making, choices, consequences. And we talked about how to do that. All right, so today, number six, we are retailers of blessing. Retailers of blessing. I've been there many times at our church. It's something that we do a lot of, the blessing. After somebody is baptized on Sunday morning, if it's one of our teenagers, we'll gather around them. Very often the elders will be there to lay their hands on, to affirm, to bless. And now, usually the Sunday mornings, if somebody is baptized, the family will host a little reception across the street and invite all the significant people. The Bible school teachers, the people in their small group, covenant group, any elders that maybe were special to them or whatever staff person is closest to this child, will gather around, and around the room we all say one word to the child. One word of affirmation, one sentence, one paragraph to call them deeper into the faith and to tell them we bless them. In our own little covenant group yesterday, our own little small group, every once in a while we'll have the adults write the children a blessing. And we make sure that you don't have to write one for your child. I'll take somebody else's child. And I'll say, here's my blessing to you. And last time we did it, one of the parents said that night, their daughter, who was four at the time, slept with her blessing. She put it on her pillow and she slept with it. Just the power of the church and of parents and brothers and sisters in the faith saying, we want to bless you. Well, let me back up a little. What is a blessing? A blessing is the communication, either verbal or nonverbal, of unconditional love to children that tells them that they are special, that we are fortunate to know them, and that we will never stop loving them. The Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make His face shine upon you and give you peace. You know where that's from? Numbers chapter 6, that's the Lord's blessing. That's the Lord putting His hand on you and saying, Lord bless you and keep you. The Beatitudes, Matthew chapter 5, verses 3 and following, are really blessings from God. A way to translate that, it's hard to know how to do it, but I think the best way would be something like, God's blessings on you who are poor in spirit. God's blessings on you who mourn. God's blessings on you who hunger and thirst for righteousness. God's blessings on you. It's Jesus pronouncing blessings from God. It's not a call to be poor in spirit. It's Jesus reaching out and saying, God blesses you. God is greatly pleased with you. God fully accepts you. But God is not the only one in Scripture who blesses. If you've got a Bible, look at Genesis 27. Genesis 27. So he went to him and kissed him. When Isaac caught the smell of his clothes, he blessed him and said, Ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May the Lord give you heaven's dew and of earth's richness and abundance of grain and new wine. May nations serve you and peoples bow down to you. What a great blessing. Now look at Genesis 48. Here we have a grandfather's blessing, which is one of the most powerful from a grandma or a grandpa. Then the Lord blessed Joseph, then he blessed Joseph and said, May the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has delivered me from all harm, may he bless these boys. May they be called by my name and the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they increase greatly upon the earth. That's a blessing, because all of these days, these children are going to have people tearing them down. You're not smart enough, you're not athletic enough, you're not this enough, you're not that enough. Just constant carping all the time. I love the story of the guy that's walking past the pet store. And as he walks by, the parrot says, Hey, mister. He turns and he's kind of shocked and he says, Hey, what? The parrot says, You're stupid and your wife's ugly. The man couldn't believe the parrot said that, so he went in and he complained to the pet store owner. The pet store owner went up and got the parrot and started smacking that parrot back and forth and back and forth. The man was aghast. He said, I didn't mean for you to do that. Thank you for taking care of it, though. And as he walks out, the parrot says, "Okay, mister." And he turns to him and says, "Hey, what?" And the parrot says, "You know." Well, every child, I think, is out there with that kind of carping, that kind of tearing down. You know what's wrong with you. You see this flaw. You see this part of you. And we enter in with blessings and we say, "No, the Lord bless you and keep you." We can nearly ruin our kids' lives if we fail to give them this blessing. Because they wind up driven, they wind up trying to gain acceptance by performance. It leads to overachieving and exhaustion or destructive behavior. People don't mean it bad. Some don't bless their kids because of ignorance. Some people think, oh, you know, they'll get spoiled if they hear too much affirmation. I don't think so. Or it's going to inflate their ego. Or they know I love them without my having to say it. Some people don't bless because they weren't blessed as children. They grew up in those families where you're just left off to the side and you're expected to show up for meals. And so that ugly chain of non-affirmation continues to be passed along. Some don't bless because they're too busy. They're so caught up in their schedule that they never stop. And time together is about as rare as a sight of the Hale-Bopp comet. But here is how you bless a child. If you're taking notes, here's how you bless a child. Number one, you bless a child through meaningful touch. Mark chapter 10 and verse 16 says, "Jesus took the children in his arms. He put his hands on them and he blessed them." Mark chapter 1 and verse 40, "Jesus took the leper and he touched him." Now I'm interested. Jesus could have blessed people and healed them with remote control, but he's continually bringing them to him and he's touching them. Why is Jesus always touching? Because there's a power in these hands. Parents shouldn't act like kids are left off to the side. Some parents only touch their kids when they're dressing them or putting them in a child seat. There's very little lap time, very little wrestling time. But the power of a blessing is just touching a child, stroking a child's hair, holding a child. I have incredible memories of the last days of my daughter's life. Megan was 10, very sick. And I'll never forget these powerful memories, night after night after night, of walking by and into the middle of the night, my wife is rocking Megan. And she's just stroking her hair and she's singing about heaven. I didn't think Megan would die. I kept believing, no, once again she's going to get better. But Diane knew. She had this mother's intuition that Megan wouldn't live. And so night after night, she didn't miss a chance. She just kept stroking her hair and singing about heaven. So all night long, even when I'm in there sleeping, I'd hear this sweet voice singing, "Heaven is a wonderful place. And to Canaan's land I'm on my way." And then I'd hear her talking to this little child, mentally retarded and physically frail, about heaven. And I'd hear her talk about heaven and Megan, in heaven you will be able to run and talk and all the things you've wanted to bust loose and do, you'll be able to do. And night after night, this blessing, it was an ongoing blessing of months. What a privilege it is to be able to bless a child in life or in death. The morning Megan died, we gathered around her, Diane and I and her brother Matt and just a couple other people. To be able to use these hands. You know, when I talk about my hands, I don't have monstrous hands, but God has so blessed these hands. These are the hands that three little babies were put into the moment they were born. These are the hands that last summer when we went to pick up my son at the camp he'd been at in Missouri. And he said, "Dad, I believe in Christ and I want you to baptize me." These are the hands that went on his shoulders. In my mom and dad's swimming pool in southwest Missouri, the hands that got to put my son under as his mother and I blessed him. These are the hands that got to hold Megan as she died. And to say to her as she took her last breath, "May the Lord bless you and keep you." An old man from our church came in, oldest man in the church. They weren't letting anybody in ICU, but he told him he was the granddad. You know, I'm not here for moral judgments. And he came in and he put his hands on Megan. And he raised a hand to heaven. And he said, "May the gates of heaven open wide to receive this little angel." She took her last breath. Power of hands. These little things you've got here. You may think these are just appendages to pick up food, but it's much more than that. These are instruments of righteousness by God. Instruments of grace. God gave you these hands to touch. We don't pray antiseptically anymore for people in our elders' meetings. When it's time for prayer, we stick them in the middle and the 29 elders and the staff gather around and everybody puts hands on. We're through being scared of Pentecostal concerns because we now know something about the power of touch. It means a lot to me when my wife reaches out and just touches me. It means a lot when I reach out and I touch my kids, my 15-year-old. I don't even know that he particularly wants it right now. I'm still bigger than him. Not entirely. His neck is bigger and shoulders and biceps and thighs and calves, but I've still got him 2 inches in the waist. And I'll go at night and I'll run my hands sometimes down that muscular back. And I don't even have to say anything. It's just the touch. And I'm not good at this. I'm just learning. But for you grandmas and grandpas, and incidentally, one of the most needed things that's needed today is for daddies to touch their little girls. If you want to know how to deal with some of the problems of teenage pregnancies, one of the answers I have is for fathers to appropriately and lovingly touch their little girls, to hold them and hug them and wrestle with them just like with the little boys, and to rock them. We bless our children through these hands. Number two, we bless our children through meaningful words. "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me," is one of the stupidest sayings in our heritage. Recently, in a waiting room at the hospital, I saw and heard a young mother nearly throw her infant son to a friend and say, "Take this and get it out of my sight." Tears welled up. I just wanted to stop and say, "I bet nobody ever loved you, but you've got to break that chain. You've got to say things to these kids. You've got to tell them that you are greatly blessed." At our church in eighth grade, there's a special time, eighth grade faith something class. I can't think right now. Faith decisions class, that's what it is. It's one of the biggest things in religious education. When they're in eighth grade in the springtime, we take our two best teachers at the Highland Church. We pull all the eighth graders out and we put them with all of their parents and we meet together. I know this because that was us last year. We were parents last year of an eighth grader. And they walk us from Genesis to Revelation in just about 10 weeks. They tell the biblical story, but along the way they let parents and children talk about what this faith means. And let the kids ask, "What was the first memory you had of church? What's the biggest struggle you had about church?" And then one night they had the parents bring a blessing to the children. And so Diane wrote her blessing to Matt and I wrote my blessing to Matt. And then we stood at before all of these people, and we read blessings. To speak words of affirmation, words of futurizing. That's the third part. The third way to bless someone is to envision a special future for them. Because you know that they're different. You can't ask every child to be a teacher or every child to be a doctor. They're going to be different. You've got to know the differences in your children. It's just like when it comes time to watch television. If you've got a half hour to watch television, is it as insane in your house as it is in ours? Nobody wants to watch the same thing. I think back several years ago, Megan died 2.5 years ago, so I'm thinking back before that. We all, if we wanted to watch television, Diane wanted CNN, I wanted ESPN, Matt wanted Nickelodeon, Christopher wanted a Barney video, and Megan didn't care as long as she stood right in front of the television where nobody else could see. Or when it's time to go out to eat, how does that work? Okay, where do you want to go out to eat? How is a decision made there? Everybody has one thing they're looking for. What's the teenage son looking for? Bulk. Teenage daughter? Environment, atmosphere, ambiance, friends. Mom? Nutrition. Dad, cheap. So, you know, if you can find a healthy, all-you-can-eat buffet, you know, with nice ambiance, you've got it made. But everybody's got a different interest here. Everybody's got something different because we are different. And so your goal as a parent is to find out. You study this child. It's my job to know this 4-year-old named Christopher and this 15-year-old named Matt. And they look like carbon copies a decade apart. But they're different. It's my job. It's my job as a preacher of the Highland Church to know the Bible. But it's my job as the parent of Matt and Christopher to know these two lives. And then to bless them by envisioning a future. Maybe you say to a child, God has given you such a sensitive heart. I wouldn't be surprised if you end up helping a lot of people when you get older. You don't have to name the professions. You don't have to work out everything. You don't have to get them into medical school or whatever. You just say, you have such a heart for people. I think God's going to use that. Or, you know, you're such a good helper. When you grow up and marry someday, you're going to be such a help to your wife and your family. Boy, it's locked in there. It will never be lost. It is right in there saying, I'm a helper. That's my identity. We've had a chance to say to Matt, not everybody has the privilege of living 10 years with someone who's retarded. Boy, We bet He's wired you to defend the people without a voice. We bet He's wired you to defend the underdog. We bet you're going to be a man of great justice. We bet you're going to be one who hates racism and hates the way that churches are always trying to separate those with special needs and those who we call normal and so on. We bet you're one of the ones that's going to try to bring down walls. We've tried to help him envision that future. The Lord bless you and keep you. I want to keep going, but I do want to say something about the next one as well. Let's go to Wholesalers of Fun. I have a good friend, Terry Smith, who told me that his kids told him as they were growing up that, Dad, you are too religious. You got to get over it. You got to lighten up. And he said he got to thinking about it, and it's true. It is possible to get a religious kernel stuck between your teeth. There is a place for fun, just absolute fun. Let me read you some Proverbs. I'll give you where they're from, and you can write them down. Proverbs 15 and verse 13. A happy heart makes the face cheerful, but heartache crushes the spirit. Chapter 15 and verse 30. A cheerful look brings joy to the heart and good news gives health to the bones. Proverbs 17 and verse 22. A cheerful heart is good medicine, but a crushed spirit dries up the bones. Harmon Killebrew, during a speech at his induction into the Hall of Fame, told about how his dad used to go out and play ball with the boys all the time in the yard, and they'd stomp around the yard in their lawn, and he remembers the time his mom yelled out the window from the kitchen. She yelled out, "You're killing the grass!" And his dad hollered back, "We ain't raising grass, we raising boys!" And you know, he's right. The sandbox will kill the lawn. The swing set's going to kill the lawn. The plastic wading pool will kill the lawn. The basketball will kill the lawn. But we ain't raising lawn. And believe me, in West Texas, it's a prized commodity. We're raising kids. We're raising kids. I've learned the levels of things that tug my wife's chain, as we all do. Kind of halfway up the ladder is, this is mom's rule. You do not throw a ball in the house. We have a lawn. But we don't throw balls in the house. Well, it is the most broken rule in our house. We always throw balls in the house. I mean, you know, we're in the house and we love to throw balls, so we throw balls in the house. And when we're caught, you know, Matt and I do what you should do. We point to the 4-year-old and said he threw it. And not too long ago, the 4-year-old and I were playing catch. And we weren't supposed to. It's, you know, it's against the rule in our house. And sure enough, one got away and it busted one of her knickknacks on the fireplace. It was just horrendously ugly, I might add, as a sidelight. But you know, that's not part of the issue here. The issue is what level of punishment would be doled out. And I was so proud, because we'd never really tested that rule before. I mean, we'd broken it a million times. We just never tested it. And Diane came in, swept it up and said, "You guys playing ball, huh?" "Okay." And that was it. Because we ain't raising knickknacks. Beautiful as they are, we're raising boys. Well, the trick here is that fun is not a 4-letter word. Fun is a part of a family. There are a couple books that came out back in the 80s that pointed out how children are losing their childhood anymore. One was David Elkind's The Hurried Child, and one was Neil Postman's The Disappearance of Childhood. And in their books, they talk about how partly kids lose their childhood because the marketing firms are over here needing them to be adolescents. Because once you become an adolescent, then you got money, then you're buying. So they want kids to be adolescents quickly. They don't want you to be an adolescent when you're 15. They want you to be one when you're 10 or 9 or 8 or whatever they can convince you. And then on the other hand, there's this tugging that comes from parents who think that every test a third grader takes will determine whether they get into Harvard or not. You know, so everything has equal seriousness. But we are wholesalers of fun. It's your job as a parent to make sure there are times at home that are just fall over silly fun. The Old Testament is full of celebrations. Can you imagine what it would have been like to be a Jewish family? All the celebrations and the festivals that came every year, they would link faith and family and fun together. They'd give you a chance to grow in your love of God and your love of your family at the same time while having a good time. For example, Passover. Have you really read Passover carefully in the Old Testament? They had this incredible meal, incredible storytelling, and as a side note, have you ever really counted the number of glasses of wine that they had with that meal? These people were throwing a party. And tabernacles, the Feast of Tabernacles, they'd go live in a tent together. They'd put up a big tent and they'd camp out together. That sounds like 2 days of great fun to me. Unfortunately, it lasted 7. It sounds like 2 days of great fun. After that, there's room for killing one another, is our experience in a tent. We're kind of a two-night-in-a-tent family. But they're celebrating that God is good, that our security doesn't rest on our home. It doesn't rest with mortar and brick and wood. It rests with God. So we'll live in this little lean-to this week to remember that God alone is our dwelling place. There are few things that bind families together like traditions that are fun. I'm going to walk through a few of ours, but I don't much care about that for right now. I'm just using them for you to stir up within your mind the things that probably are traditions to your kids that may not be to you. Now, one of them with us is Halloween. We've got great fun traditions at Halloween. One of them is that Dad is the official carver of the jack-o'-lantern. And when the jack-o'-lantern is carved, we take out the seeds, we separate it from the pulp, we put the seeds on paper towels for a while to let them dry. And then we roast the seeds and eat them. Or incidentally, little side note, for better taste, just skip that and eat the paper towels they were on. It's really about equally tasty. We don't do it because it tastes good, we do it because it's what we do. Another thing we do is we cook spaghetti. Now, you know, big deal, cheap meal. But that's... we did that for a long time in Searcy, and my sister and her daughter would come over, and we cook spaghetti because you can do it quick, and you can slurp it down, and you're gone. You're ready to hit the streets, trick-or-treating. And then one year, we were getting ready to do something else, and Matt came over in all seriousness and said, "We have spaghetti for Halloween." We said, "What do you mean we have spaghetti for Halloween?" He says, "We always do." Well, "we always do" meant the last 2 years we had done that, but by then it was a fun tradition. Did you get to trick-or-treat with spaghetti sauce all over you? It was like now a law of the Medes and the Persians that that's what we do. And Thanksgiving and Christmas, think of all the traditions you've got built in there or could build in, something that's vital to them. One of ours, some of you have heard me talk about, is the quarter in the bottom of the stocking every Christmas. It's a tradition. Because a long time ago in Chicago, the first OBGYN in Chicago was my something, great-grandfather, I think. But he got called away to World War I, and that left the family without any in a house that was too big. So they were losing everything. My great-grandmother lost nearly everything. And all she had for Christmas was a quarter for each child in the bottom of the stocking underneath all the, you know, the orange and whatever was put in there. And now for, what, 70, 80 years? That's what happens in my family. This next Christmas, when the boys go on Christmas morning, they're going to pull out an apple, pull out an orange, pull out some candy, and there'll be a quarter because it's a family tradition that reminds us that our family is going to survive whether the year is good or not because we believe in God. Some years are good. Babies are born. But our experience is some years are bad. Children can die. But each year, God has been good. And we will make it. Well, what does your family do together that's fun? Think about the fun things you do and accentuate that. Some of the things cost a little money, but there are other things that don't cost much. It's amazing to me. Have you ever been to Disney World and seen, we've done this before, where you save up and you go and your expectations are sky high and you get there and it wasn't quite as much fun as camping out? Or you get there and you're having a pretty good time, but you see all these families screaming at one another. No, I said, you've got to stand in this line right now. We paid $70 to get in here. Now stand here. We're having fun. Now that's a good time. You know. You pay $95 to stand in 95 degree weather with 95% humidity and a 95 minute wait for every ride. And we call that fun. Well, it can be if you approach it with the right attitude. But I'm thinking more of things that don't cost a lot. I will my whole life get mileage out of... I was speaking up to a citywide something or other in Portland 2 years ago, and I took Matt with me. You know, I just splurged, bought an extra plane ticket, took him up there, and after I preached, the deal was that Tim Woodruff was going to take us up on one of the huge mountains in the snow, and we'd go backpacking. 4 feet of snow underneath us, snowshoes on, and there we go, up this mountain. And we got to a point where it was so hard going that we had to take turns in front. Well, when it was Matt's turn, he went along and he hit a soft spot and sunk down all 48 inches, I think. He was about schnoz deep in snow. And he said, "What do I do?" And I said, "Don't move." And he said, "I can't move." And I said, "All right, we'll get you out." He sat there kind of sweating and panicking as we dug him out. But our whole life, the fun of that will be enjoyed. Cheap stuff like hiking together, carrying apples and raisins are meaningful to us. Reading through the Chronicles of Narnia every year, or The Hobbit, or for you maybe Anne of Green Gables or Black Beauty. Something like Tuesday or Thursday night watching Home Improvement with a bowl of popcorn, or going to Mr. Gaddy's with a roll of quarters and a set of earplugs. Just doing anything that's fun together, wrestling together, telling Bible stories where you interact together. And I think especially here, it's important to tell men that this is not just a job for our wives. It's a job where dads need to enter in. Dads, if you like to go out quail hunting, then take your kid along. See if she wants to go with you, if he wants to go with you. If you go to the golf course, take them along. If you go to a game at the ballpark, don't just call one of your guy friends. Take your kids along. Such a great joy. Now I want to give three helpful hints and then two helpful qualities. Hint number one is not everything has to be a lesson. I'm bad about this. I'm a preacher. Everything I think of is a potential lesson. But not everything has to be a lesson. Not everything has to be turned into a parable. If your last name is not Aesop, then go easy on the lessons. Number two, not every mistake has to be corrected. And we were bad about that with our first child. We're learning now, if you don't want those dumb little knickknacks played with, don't leave them down here. Put them up there.
And not every mistake's got to be corrected. Don't use a sledgehammer to kill a mouse. Number three, not every action has to be proper. Generally speaking, I'm kind of a diet freak. Pasta and vegetables is better than a cheese and mayonnaise sandwich. But I'm also learning the importance of lightening up once in a while. Grab a cookie, pull out a stupid video, have a meal and see who can eat the most fat grams at one time. Have you ever noticed, incidentally, that nearly every church has a candy man? They're probably candy women too, but I've never met one. How many of you are from a church that has a candy man? Okay, how many of you are from a church that has a cauliflower man? Broccoli man? Asparagus man? We seem to remember more the candy man. At our church, it's John Willis. Bless his heart, some of you know John Willis, internationally known Old Testament scholar, PhD from who cares where, as far as the kids are concerned. And they know John Willis not as one of the most brilliant Hebrew scholars in the world. They know him as the candy man. Because he knows that it's good for kids to have fun associated with church. Now quickly, two necessary ingredients. Number one is patience. Just write down Ephesians 6 and verse 4 and look at it later. Don't expect kids to act like adults. You'll never have fun. And number two is forgiveness. It's the oil that keeps the engine from overheating. That leaves me 1.5 minutes to talk about number eight, designers of freedom. Let me just give you the point here. The point is that one of my jobs as a parent is to prepare my child to get out of the house. I've got about 18 years to get him out and to teach him or her how to exist on their own. So I have the job of learning how to give freedom. It starts at the earliest age. You've had the experience before of a child coming in and say, "Mom, I'm bored. I'm so bored." I know Diane's heard it while I've been here the last day or two because it's Easter time and they're 2 days off from school and so on. How many of you parents have recently heard, "Mom or Dad, I am bored"? You know, we're wired genetically to say that. You know what the best answer to that is? "Oh, honey, I understand. I understand that. Sometimes mommy gets bored too. Now get out of here." Because it's a way of saying, "Oh, I understand. I get bored too. That's life. Now get out of here and go do something. I can't fix it for you." But we always want to slip in and save it. But along the way, you go from first birthday to first big boy or big girl pants to first haircut to first day at school to first tooth coming out, and all these firsts. And we had another one last night, incidentally. I might just tell you, if you see bags under my eyes. 11 o'clock, I had just fallen asleep and the phone rang. It was Diane to call me, calling to tell me Matt, 15, his first inner circle of friends has this week turned 16. And we have a rule in our family that only one of us needs to worry about something. But it's like a germ. If I give it to you, I'm through with it. Diane was unable to sleep because she was worried. So she called me to let me know. I'm sure she went right to sleep after that. I was up till 2 in the morning worrying about that. They had just wanted to run over to Emily's house for a minute. And I'm thinking of all the things I know about this friend, 16 years old. Could he be 16? Seems like he's maybe 9. 9, 16. It's a fine line, really, between 9 and 16 in my mind last night. In fact, I was thinking of more responsible 9-year-olds who I wish were driving. This was all happening. And I got to tell you, I mean, honestly, on top of all of that, I can't bury another child. I can't do that. You know, you will not hear me speak again, I think, if I have to bury another child. I can't do that deal again. But there's something back here that says, all right, children can die. So I've got to make sure that I don't overreact against that by saying, all right, Matt, you know what happened to your sister? You can't do anything. I've even more got to say, no, it is my job as a parent to give freedom. Age appropriate to a 4-year-old or an 8-year-old or a 12-year-old or a 16-year-old. But more freedom as they go. Now, ultimately, the freedom is, one of the markers is when they marry. We've got to cut them loose. You can't control those kids when they marry. You've got to let them make those dumb decisions. You've got to let them go without asking for your help if they want to. But even along the way,
we're giving them a little more freedom all the time. It's what God has done for you. God has wired you so that you have capacity for freedom. And our kids are going to have to live in a free world. They've got to make decisions. And along the way, as much as we can, hand that to them. Oh, what a blessing it'll be. Well, I've taken you to the limit now. I know several of you have come all 3 days. And I thank you. I'm so glad not to have to do anything controversial this year. This is, incidentally, if I'm going to travel from now on, Diane and I have kind of decided for a while, I want to do stuff like parenting and marriage and so on. I feel more passionate about that. It's that time in life where I feel called by God to do that a little more. But anyway, thanks for coming.